Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jessica Yates, counsel for appellant Micromotion. With me here today is Tim O'Neill, one of my partners, Ms. Melomer, and I'd like to save 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to start with the issue of the jury instruction in this case. That's instruction number 24, relating to the negligence per se ordinance-based instruction that omitted the reference to a rebuttable presumption for a rear-ending event. Now, Ms. Rodati argues that this was based on a pattern jury instruction, and therefore it's somehow unassailable. But of course, pattern jury instructions do not purport to and cannot change Colorado law.
Ms. Yates, I don't mean to interrupt you before you get your head of steam going,
sorry.
But before you get to the merits, would you address the preservation issue? Because I have to be candid, I think there's a real concern here. I understand your argument I'm less understanding how this one was preserved.
Sure, Your Honor. So this was an issue, an instruction that came out at the very last day of trial. So Ms. Rodarte had not introduced this instruction during the Rule 16 deadlines. And it really did come out of the blue. Basically, it was revealed to the parties during the jury instruction conference that she had requested an ordinance instruction. And the judge asked, well, let's talk about that ordinance. And she read it into the record, just the ordinance. There was an objection based on a confusion to the jury and misleading the jury because there was already a rebuttable presumption instruction, that's instruction number 8, that had already been agreed to by the court. And the court had already acknowledged that that was the law. And to be clear, Ms. Rodarte has not cross-appealed on that issue.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but
sure.
What exactly was the objection? I mean, my memory is, and I could be dead wrong, was that it was, you know, objection will be confusing with instruction number 8, period. As with not an explanation of why it was confusing, that this one is rebuttable, that one wasn't. I guess what I'm saying is I don't remember the objection using or expressing a concern. There's no rebuttable presumption language here. I could be wrong.
And Your Honor, I think the problem was that when Ms. Rodarte's counsel read it into the record, it wasn't clear whether there was a rebuttable presumption language because it was just the ordinance itself. It turned out that the instruction that ended up being submitted to the jury had additional language that was not disclosed at that time. And that additional language is the real problem. There's also the problem of it just being confusing, getting two different jury instructions, as the Silva case points out. But the real problem language was that they had to find negligence if the ordinance was violated, and that was not disclosed at that time.
The Micromotion never saw the draft of the instruction before the jury got it?
Your Honor, from the record, it's not clear. There's no record of it actually being shown to Micromotion, so that would be outside the record. I can tell you I've asked counsel, and they don't actually recall getting a written instruction.
All right. Did someone object when the court read the instructions? Did someone stand up and object? Wait a minute, that's not what you agreed to?
Your Honor, I believe the answer is no, because there's an assumption, and I think it's a reasonable assumption on the part of trial counsel, that nothing is being slipped in between the time that jury instructions are debated and agreed to by a trial counsel.
Sure, but if somebody got slipped in when the court read it, you knew it got slipped in.
I think if you were listening for something to be slipped in, but I think that counsel just assumes that the integrity of the jury instruction conference and process would not allow for somebody to just slip something in.
Was there not a situation where the court said, what are your objections to these instructions that I am going to be giving?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there's anything in the record showing that there was a second opportunity to review those written instructions and to object on that basis.
It looked like the trial court was, from the flip side of that, somewhat frustrated, stating, you know, if you'd have brought that to my attention, I could have considered it then and then made a ruling on the jury instruction, instead of bringing it to my attention after the trial's over and the jury's come down with its verdict. And that's sort of what we're also faced with.
Sure, Your Honor. And I think that looking at it from the other perspective, Ms. Rodarte's counsel did not actually disclose the full instruction when this was being debated. I think that it would have immediately been brought to their attention because medical motion had repeatedly brought up this rebuttable presumption issue. And I direct the court to the Silva case, which we cite in our reply brief, actually for a different proposition, but it has a great discussion and instruction on preservation in a situation very similar to this, where there had been a repeated objection on a particular basis. Later, when it came out in the jury instructions, there was only a general objection that was not as specific as the earlier ones, but the court recognized there had been a pattern here, and we can infer that the objection was properly before the court at that time. I would like to talk just a moment about the negligence per se instruction. Ms. Rudarte also argues that this is somehow a different theory of liability, and that under the common law, negligence per se, that was a rebuttable presumption, but under the statutory negligence per se, there's not. That is not a theory of liability she ever presented below. She did not plead it. It's not in the trial management order. She didn't argue it in the jury instruction conference because, again, it was not disclosed that there would be this additional language that you must find negligence.
But the complaint actually used the word ordinance.
It did in its single negligence-based pleading. But it didn't actually, for one thing, in the negligence per se, you're supposed to explain the ordinance and how it's supposed to benefit a particular class. But she didn't plead that there would be no rebuttable presumption, and she didn't preserve that as a separate theory of liability. She's now telling the court on appeal these are two different theories of liability, but that was not disclosed in the trial management order. And she didn't argue it in the jury instruction conference either.
And again, on preservation here, did Micromotion object that this is not even a theory in the case? I don't remember seeing that ever.
Your Honor, they didn't, because she didn't disclose that she would be claiming no rebuttable presumption under statutory negligence per se theory.
Or was there even an objection that, Judge, there's no negligence per se claim in this case? Why are we talking about this?
Your Honor, there was not an objection on that basis. It was confusing and misleading in light of the fact that the jury would have already been instructed on common law negligence per se.
And let me ask you, while you're talking about the merits here on this rebuttal presumption, I may be confused about the law, and so I could use your help. Negligence per se, your argument is there should have been instruction, there should have been rebuttable presumption. It's always been my understanding, and I think Silva says this, that negligence per se establishes the standard of care and breach. That's when we talk about that you establish negligence, that's what that means. So we've got the first two elements of a common law negligence claim. And I think Silva says negligence per se conclusively, the violation of statute conclusively establishes the standard of care and the breach. If that law is right, or they'd be totally off base here, where does the rebuttable presumption part fit into a claim for negligence per se? I guess I wasn't understood there. It's a very different concept.
Well, in your honor, I think this is a unique situation for rear-ending accidents. You have the presumption that the following driver is negligent unless you have evidence of negligence on the part of the leading driver. In the Huntoon case, which was also based on an ordinance or a statute, I think it might have been the Colorado statute for reckless driving or something like that, it still offers that presumption. I think the problem that we have here is that she introduced an ordinance-based instruction, which was following too closely. With, of course, there's no traffic ticket, no traffic investigation, no evidence about how close the cars were to each other, no expert opinion about how close the cars should have been to each other. So she treated this as a rear-ending instruction. It wasn't actually a different type of instruction. And under that type of situation, Silva says, you've got the common law statute that are basically being the same, and the instructions should reflect each other. You shouldn't be having two separate sets of instructions. And that's actually one of the comments as well to the pattern jury instruction for negligence per se.
I'm afraid I'm not sure I fully follow that. So you're arguing that the court treated these really as one and the same, that the rear end presumption, that there was a kind of instruction, I guess 8 and 24 were essentially getting to the same thing, and that's why they're inconsistent?
They in terms of the conduct that's the problem, that was treated as the same. Actually, Ms. Rodarte in her closing argument treated it the same way. Said, well, that Mr. Job was following too closely because he rear-ended her. no evidence whatsoever of the distance between the cars. So that was treated the same. The problem was, is the rebuttal presumption was in one instruction, but expressly undermined in the second instruction.
But aren't those two different things? I mean, we have the rebuttal presumption from a rear-end accident that the law establishes, common law establishes that presumption. And then separate from that, we have negligence per se, a violation of the ordinance gets you conclusively established standard of care and breach. Why are those the same? Maybe that's what I'm not understanding.
They are the same in this case, because there's no evidence that he was following too closely, except for the fact that the rear-ending occurred.
Okay, thank you.
In another case, Your Honor, you're absolutely right. There could have been an accident reconstruction, there could have been a traffic ticket, that kind of thing. I'd like to move on to the photograph that violated the way it was presented. The testimony questioning violated the order and the motion to eliminate. Ms. Rigarte claims on appeal that order only pertained to inferences about physical injury. Again, that's not how she presented it below. She moved to eliminate to exclude all of the vehicular photographs because of the chain of inferences that would allow for speculation by non-expert witnesses and speculation by the jury. And that chain of inferences was no damage to the vehicles, there couldn't have been much of a speed or an impact, and there couldn't have been the injury that she's claiming. And she wanted to get all of that out because it would be pure speculation, as she argued it. The court agreed with her in part and said, well, the photographs can come in, but you can't argue inferences from those photographs that would necessarily be within the realm of expert testimony. But that is exactly what she did. We're talking about an accident reconstruction being argued through questions in cross-examination by trial counsel.
Again, though, let's talk about preservation. The argument, the objection was very, very specific. It didn't say violation of the motion in limine. It simply said what?
Speculation and foundation.
Yes, and how is that a violation of a motion in limine order?
Okay. And I would like to start off by saying that that's an independent basis that the court could find error, because obviously speculation and foundation were preserved objections, and the court could reverse on that basis. But in terms of the order and the motion in limine, two things. One is that was the basis for Ms. Rodarte's motion in limine, was lack of foundation and speculation on the part of lay witnesses. But second, Micromotion then asked in a Rule 59 motion for a new trial and raised this specific issue. And even though Rule 59 motions don't always preserve, in this case, the district court did rule squarely on issue and found that the order in limine had not been clearly violated. And gave no indication that the court would have found otherwise if it had been brought to the court's attention right there during trial. I also want to make mention that we know of no authority that would allow a violation of an order in limine just to cross-examine witnesses. This is something that she could have done without reference to the photographs. And this new diving down through technical theory of slamming on the brakes, having the bumpers meet up, that is something that was inherently prejudicial to Micromotion. Micromotion obviously had no opportunity to prepare or consider getting an expert. They couldn't rehabilitate the witness because the real problem was this argumentative questioning on the part of trial counsel. And the other evidence of causation was insufficient in this case.
Let me ask you, Ms. Yates, I know you may want to save time.
Yeah.
Couldn't a lay witness testify that when you slam on the brakes, the front goes down? Why do you need an expert to say that?
I'm not sure you need an expert to say that, but the evidence that was solicited in this case was that the marks on her bumper were necessarily caused by his bumper, and that would require a fairly technical reconstruction of exactly how far it had gone down. And Your Honor, I would like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Stephen Cook. My registration number is 6692. With respect to the issue of whether the defendant preserved the argument on instructional error, respectfully submit that it did not. Counsel was given an opportunity to review the instructions. Both counsel were at a lengthy jury instruction conference that began on, page 99 of the trial record on the 25th, June 25th, and goes to page 129. You will see that the court walked in and said we began a jury instruction conference the day before. That's also reflected in the record. And now I've organized the instructions. I'm handing them to counsel. Please describe what your objections are and make any further submissions. It goes on for 30 pages. It's lengthy. As the court has noted in questioning, the only objection made by counsel to the instruction number 24, which was the negligence per se instruction, was that it was confusing and misleading in light of the presumption. And I respectfully submit that that isn't clear. And as Judge Pratt said, in a fairly lengthy and well-reasoned motion or order on that motion in trial, said if you'd given me a chance to address this, I could have then. I'm going to argue that it didn't matter, that both you could give both those instructions, it isn't a problem. But I don't think this court should address that or have to address that because the error was not preserved.
Counsel, Ms. Yates said during her presentation that the way the conference actually worked is there wasn't a jury instruction presented to be objected to. They were reading from an ordinance, and then later the jury instruction was created and it included additional language that they were not aware of or sent back. Can you address that?
So I too was at the jury instruction conference, and I was the lawyer who conducted the jury instruction conference on behalf of the plaintiff. Instruction number 24 was based on CJI Civil 914, the stock instruction. And all the instructions had been submitted by each side to the court the day before. He had organized them, and on the last day of trial, on the conference again, on page 99 I cited, he handed them back to counsel and said, here's what I'm going to do. You tell me if you want to object or not. Instruction 914 was one of the ones we submitted. Instruction 914 contains the language, quote, a violation of this ordinance constitutes negligence, close quote. The portion of the record being cited by micromotion in this appeal relates to the section of the instruction where you've got to show the underlying law or ordinance. And so that was read to the judge at the record, on the record, and was in the instruction. The assertion that, as I understand it, the assertion is that even though the judge had handed back instruction number 24, which is based on 914, it only contained the first two paragraphs of instruction number 24, and which is at the time of the appearance in question, this ordinance of the city of Parker was in effect, and it says an auto traffic code. It wasn't that way. It would have been silly if it read that way. It would have made no sense. It doesn't complete the purpose of the instruction. So all I can tell you is that 914 was submitted by plaintiff as was ultimately given back by the court, and the record refers to the instruction. And of course, it was read to the jury. Of course, it is in the record. Unfortunately, nobody raised at the time, and therefore I can't say to you that the record shows that that sentence, quote, a violation of this ordinance constitutes negligence, was in the version of 914 that was submitted back by the court to counsel at the instruction conference. On the other hand, there is no evidence that was not, except for this reference to us reading in, the partner reading in, the underlying ordinance that was the basis for the instruction. Have I been responsive?
Yeah, thank you.
With respect to the merits of the instruction, in fact, the concept of negligence, it's a rebuttable presumption in the following too closely provision of Colorado law, under the ordinance, not rebuttable, versus the rear end collision instruction, are two different instructions arising from two different types of occurrences. A rear end collision arises from an event. If there is this event, and it happens, you can assume that in that situation, a rear end collision, somebody was probably negligent. I go back to my first year tort clause, I was thinking last night, 42 years ago, and there was the case about the barrel that rolls out the second floor of the business that stores things in barrels. And normally the second floor doors have some kind of loading system that allows the barrels to be unloaded. But that day, the barrel rolls out the open doors and there's nobody unloading them and there's nothing to bring them down. And the barrel lands on a pedestrian walking underneath. That's an event. And it gives rise to a presumption of negligence. Maybe we don't. We won't. Now assume that the same city where that business is located has an ordinance that says, hey, if you store barrels on their side, you've got to use a safety feature, a barrel stopper. And now assume there's some evidence. One employee says, hey, we always use the barrel stoppers. Another employee says, you know, I think that day we didn't use it on that one. So there's an inference from which the jury could conclude that the ordinance was violated. Okay, so then you get an instruction that says, hey, if they weren't using the barrel stopper, they were violating the ordinance, and that's negligent. And you must find it was negligent. You're not limited to one or the other. The jury might have found that they didn't use the barrel stopper, but still found that there was negligence in the barrel rolling out the door. In this case, there is evidence there was a rear end collision. There are many ways a rear end collision can happen. You can be looking to the side to wave to a person who you think is a friend, not pay attention, rear end the car in front of you. You could be adjusting your radio station, not pay attention, rear end the car in front of you. Or you could be following too closely. That's the conduct that's prescribed by this ordinance.
And well, let me ask you, Mr. Cook, on this. Is it true that the first time Micromotion had any clue you were going to argue following too closely was when you submitted this instruction? Was there any pleading or any allegation before that? I know the complaint had a general statement about ordinances. It didn't mention this one specifically. I think we could agree it said something about ordinances generally. Is it accurate that the first time Micromotion ever heard anything about following too closely was when you submitted that instruction?
Well, I would say no. But if you ask me to quote from the record where we specifically said to him, gee, weren't you following too closely that day, or in my opening statement, I don't
know. Yeah, your point, that's fair. I appreciate that. But so maybe to answer the question, there's nothing in the record that we could point to before you submit the instruction, a pleading or an allegation in a document that's in the record until you submitted that instruction.
That uses the term, quote, following too closely. Off the top of my head, Your Honor, I cannot think of such a use of the term.
So I do understand the preservation issues, but why isn't that prejudicial? I mean, can you actually submit a new theory at the jury instruction conference, assuming those are the facts?
It wasn't. I respectfully submit that's not a new theory. In personal injury litigation, automobile accident cases, there are statutes and ordinances that prescribe a wide variety of conduct. And in complaints, it is routinely pled, as we submit, not only by me, but by others, that the conduct violated one or more of those ordinances or statutes. The evidence develops at trial. And based on the evidence at trial, the judge decides what, if any, negligent per se instruction would be appropriate, assuming that such an instruction is tenable. Submit that's the way it's happened. If I suppose we could have gone through and looked through a dozen or 20 or 30 different potential ordinances that conduct violated and said it in the complaint, respectfully submit that is not necessary to notice pleading, and it's also just inconsistent with the way these cases are litigated. You put evidence on the conduct, you determine what, if any, ordinance is violated, you ask the judge to give an instruction on that. This isn't, I'm going to say this fairly, but this is not pulling a rabbit out of a hat in terms of the way these cases are litigated. So no, I respectfully speak, that is not unfair.
Was there any discovery done, Mr. Cook, about the ordinance issue? Any propounded to you or your client about what's your theory about which ordinance is being violated?
As I stand here today, Your Honor, I cannot recall any such discovery. But respectfully, I didn't look at the record at that point.
Can I ask you to shift gears, Mr. Cook, because I know your time is limited. I'd like you to talk about the damages issues here and the ones that Micromotion's raised. I'll confess to you, I have some concern about the evidence of future damages. Could you help me out and tell me what the evidence was? And so I don't have to keep interrupting, I'll tell you what my concern is. I'd be interested in what damages evidence was actually submitted. I think there was $80,000 of past damages. what was the evidence of that supported the future damages?
You can listen to me while you're pulling together what you're looking for.
We have an her doctor said she was here last week or whatever, she's treated. We have some suggestion of that this woman has permanent injury. I think it's, you know, perhaps, for hypothetically speaking, I'll agree with you, that establishes, okay, there's a fact that this woman's going to need future treatment. Okay. What is the evidence of the amount of dollars that was the actual damage amount that she's going to have to pay in the future? Go for it.
Sure. First, I'd like to point out that was raised before the judge, who tried the case, heard the evidence, and rejected that argument specifically in his ruling on the motion for new trial. Your Honor,
he did, but I still don't understand what the evidence was.
Okay. So in terms of the verdict, it was based on past expenses, future expenses, physical impairment, and non-economic losses. And Your Honor, the jury had evidence, and I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. You caught me a little off guard. I didn't think that was an issue the court was going to be interested in. I apologize. The evidence was that she had, I think, something like 70, I can't remember the amount, of past medical expenses. So if it was roughly half of what they were worth or something like that. That was based on evidence in the trial, based on medical expenses submitted and her testimony about time she went off work. She'd been off work for about five, not off work, she'd been injured for about 5 years since the incident happened. She was, I think, 38 years old when this case went to trial. And the testimony was that she had a permanent injury that she would need or various types of treatment depending on her course in the future. And since she was 38 years old at the time and had a life expectancy, and again, I don't remember the exact instruction, but I think it goes on to one until she's roughly 80 years old, that the jury could then and should, we close argue, should compensate her for her future
loss. What was the evidence of the future? Is it just that she suffered this many in the past, so ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you can determine from what she suffered in the past how much it's going to cost in the future? Is that all we have?
That's one.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
Is there something more?
That what you have articulated is exactly what one of the cases says, and we've cited in the brief, that a jury can infer future losses on medical expenses based on past medical expenses. And in our system, we have people go to trial, or at least bring their claims within 3 years from when they're injured, and then typically a year or two later goes to trial. Sometimes they'll be within 1 year. The point being, I'm trying to make, is that you have young people, such as Mr. Adarte, who have to bring their claims in a couple of years and can't come back 30 years later or 20 years later or 10 years later and say, you know what, I had more medical expenses than I needed. So there is some inferential calculations that a jury must do, and we recognize that.
But usually there's an expert who says, here's what I predict she's going to suffer in the future.
And well, I respectfully disagree that usually there is. I know that some people use so-called life care planners to talk about that. It's an expensive process, and the law does not require a planner such as Mr. Rodarte to incur that expense if she chooses to go to the jury on the evidence of the past expenses being an appropriate way for them to measure her future expenses. So, and I think the case that you cited says that. It may feel uncomfortable to the court in terms of how they arrived at it, but this jury was instructed pursuant to the law, was instructed about permanency. There was clear evidence, evidence from which they could infer that she had a permanent injury, both from Dr. Bainbridge, a board-certified physiatrist, and Dr. McNabb, who was a chiropractor.
All right, so in terms of the amount, the bottom line here is that the evidence in front of the jury was that they had knew what the past damages were, and they could infer from the past damages what her future damages were. And that's what we have in terms of the amount.
And to the extent that that is so excessive as to justify some type of remitter or a new trial, please remember that they calculated over her life expectancy, if I'm remembering correctly, then roughly another 40 years, that she was only entitled to medical expenses that equal what she'd incurred in the first 5 years or so since the collision. It isn't like she incurred $1,000 in medical expenses in 5 years and then they gave her $1 million for the rest of her life. We're not dealing with those kind of extremes in the situation, and therefore it's appropriate. My time is up.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I'd first like to direct the court's attention to June 26th transcript, page 108. And that refers, starting at line 5, to the fact that Ms. Ruderte's counsel did actually pull the ordinances out the night before the last full day of trial. They had sifted through them and finally identified the one that they were looking for. This was something that was not disclosed earlier in the jury instruction conference. As I had acknowledged that there is no record that actually even pattern instruction 914 in its pattern form was given to Micromotion. But that still wouldn't have been enough to explain to Micromotion what the actual jury instruction was at the time. I do want to comment as well in terms of the following too closely. Micromotion certainly would have gotten an expert for an accident reconstruction if there had been an independent theory, but again, that was not disclosed until the last full day of trial. To get to the future damages question, as the court knows, our position is that there wasn't sufficient evidence, and this court has been firm on several occasions that there needs to be at least some sort of medical certainty of the necessary treatment, at least some recommendations. And it was clear both from Ms. Ruderte and Dr. Bainbridge that he would not be recommending the type of aggressive treatment she'd had in the past that had been so expensive. Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.